Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome our guest co-host, Dr. Jonathan Fricke.
Thanks for having me here today, Adam.
Oh, it's great to have you. You know, we're going to get to hear about a recent interview we did with Chip Hughes, the director of the Worker Education and Training Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, about reducing and preventing health hazards at work and his work being there when disasters happen and how to prevent hazards to workers. I'm looking forward to hearing that conversation. But first, we've actually got some really interesting research that matters. And one of them has to do with low back pain. And a strategy that I hadn't really thought about is the types of shoes you wear. And can that make a difference? I do know, and you know as well, that we're on our feet 8, 10, 12 hours a day. And our feet do get tired. But it's not just about the feet being tired. It's the question, do our backs get tired from the strain and stress? And can certain types of shoes help?
This was a study that took place in Spain, and they had 40 patients who had chronic low-level, low back pain. And with these patients, they split them into two groups. One of the groups got these rocker bottom shoes. So intentionally, through the day, they are having to adjust their weight to keep their balance, and they're actively engaging their core muscles and their low back muscles. Their theory was that it's easy for us to tell somebody to exercise, but it's a lot harder to actually do those physical therapy exercises every day with due diligence. And they found that there were significant benefits, that people who were actively engaging their back with these shoes through the day had lower levels of low back pain, which is pretty remarkable.
It's almost like common sense at one level. On the other hand, this is just 40 patients, and so I don't think we go out and recommend to all of our patients with chronic low back pain that they buy rocker bottom shoes, particularly if like they have balance problems, because then they may fall, and then you know they're going to say, Dr. Goldstein, you're recommending those rocker bottom shoes. You know, so okay, we're not saying that, but we are saying this is really interesting. This was in the European Journal of Physical Rehabilitation and Medicine. And it's ironic. I recently got some rocker bottom shoes, not because of the study, but just because they fit me really well and I liked them. And I said, oh, these are kind of new and different. What I have discovered is that I am using my back muscles more. It's just the way it is and the way it works. And so I do believe that there's something worth looking at this research. I'm really fascinated by it. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, about low levels of BPA, the chemical bisphosphonyl A, in this case, during pregnancy and brain development. What are we talking about?
This is talking about the link between BPA and any sort of brain development issues. And one of the issues is that we have a lot of general evidence showing that BPA can be toxic to nerve cells. But the question is, why don't we see that effect happening in society, or if it is in fact so dangerous? And so this study, the authors purport, is this is the smoking gun that we've been looking for. This is what we've been trying to find, is the evidence that this is leading to the effects that have been purported.
And I'm not so clear it's that, but it is something that I think is interesting and worth really expanding our understanding of. And they took three groups of pregnant mice, yes, mice, and one group ate food that didn't have this BPA. A second group had food at high doses of the BPA, and a third ate low doses of the BPA. And they found an increase in these nerve cells that are created during early development in those who were exposed to these different levels compared to those not exposed. And there is good data that that sort of exposure, at least in these mice, may well link up to important health outcomes. So I do think this suggests that there could be something there, that we got to say that, you know, government agencies, including the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, say that BPA is safe. What do we do with this?
I think one of the biggest concerns is with any exposure to a possible toxin, the question is the timing of the exposure, and it's also the dose of the exposure. And so BPA has been commonly in certain bottles, certain can liners. A lot have now changed to other compounds. But the timing of it, how long is food is sitting in that container, how much time does it have to soak it up? Does this container need to be heated up in order to get these toxins into whatever your food or beverage you're consuming? Also wondering, are the alternatives that are being introduced in place of BPA sometimes is actually a new sister compound called bisphenol B might not necessarily be any safer, and we have even less research on that.
So BPB and BPA, you know, common sense would dictate that one doesn't want to take plastic and heat it up to a melting point and put our food in it. Okay, that seems like a common sense recommendation. What else we do? Certainly to go from the fresh fruit, organic and grains and things that are from, you know, the closer to where they're produced to where we eat them, probably not a bad idea either. Particularly in those formative pregnancy, gestation time periods, if possible. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, which is about a condition called obsessive compulsive disorder and some new research that suggests better where we may go in some of our behavioral treatments. And I got to say, we don't really have a lot to offer a lot of people. Some of the medications that are used to treat it are not great.
This was a study where they looked at people with different problem-solving styles, and they found that patients with OCD were more likely to possess maladaptive coping skills than others, including those suffering from depression.
Yeah, they had 60 patients suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder, 110 with depression, and then a little over 1,000 who really had neither. And they were looking at, as you just said, Jonathan, this maladaptive coping, things that are really not healthy, kind of an adaptive coping mechanism. You know, can you solve problems? Can you accept what's going on and then avoidance? You don't think about it, which probably isn't the best. And, you know, those who had the OCD certainly had the more maladaptive coping skills. And I've seen this clinically. And the real question is, can you really teach kind of coping skills to help lessen the likelihood or to help reduce these behaviors rather than avoidance or using these maladaptive skills? That to me is a really important, interesting question.
It's great to see a study that suggests a possible route for treatment. And I think that future studies are going to keep looking into the ways that teaching these coping skills in the school, in the clinic, or in the household can help to lessen the impact of this disease.
Yeah, this was called cognitive therapy and research. Unless we think this is something that only affects young children, it actually affects people at all ages. And we can see it for the very first time even in our elderly population. So really important work. Our last research that matters is about the importance of education and perhaps achieving success on things like child abuse.
Adam, this is a study that comes out of research at the University of Michigan as well as the University of Washington. It came out in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence, and they looked at 356 people that they followed from childhood, and then they looked at patient reports of different violent behavior or antisocial behavior.
Yeah, and they found these for a long period of time here. So it wasn't like this was what we call a cross-sectional. They look at it one point in time and look at another, but they followed these people until they were 36 years of age. And the question was, if you had suffered from some sort of child abuse at a younger age, if you were encouraged, if you were able to stay in school, if you were able to have better grades, could that help mitigate some of that exposure compared to if those things didn't happen? And I think the short answer was it might have, but there's lots more complexity here, right?
There's no one simple answer for this. And I think ultimately what this shows to us is that when you look at the big picture, people who have trauma in their childhood, whatever sort of life-altering event that might be, down the road have worse health outcomes. And so any possibility of interventions that can be done earlier on, if it's that one teacher who helps keep this person in school, if it's somebody who helps to build resilience in a child who's been through a lot, those are things that can have tremendous impacts on somebody's overall health and well-being throughout the rest of their life.
Yeah, and we both heard a recent lecturer, Dr. Rogers, who really talks about that it may not have as much to do with the medical things that we bring forward as it does to poverty and racism and other aspects that are so linked with these types of outcomes, and that we have to be able to address the social determinants of health. Certainly preventing child abuse is the answer, but it's even more complex when we think about that we actually also have to deal with poverty.
Exactly. There's a lot of great future research questions on how exactly do we best address this, and I think this gives a lot of hope.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll hear our conversation with Chip Hughes, Director of the Worker Education and Training Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, about reducing and preventing health hazards at work. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Chip Hughes, Director of the Worker Education and Training Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, about reducing and preventing health hazards at work. Welcome, Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Dr. Goldstein. Appreciate it.
I've known you for a long time for our listeners, and I've respected your work immensely. And so I'm so grateful that you can come on the show and help us understand not only the myriad health hazards that workers in all industries face, but also the work that's being done to mitigate, to help prevent workplace injuries. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and how did you get interested in something that is as large as the planet?
Workplace health, yes, is as large as the planet, as old as antiquity. And it's something that we in public health have come to examine as sort of a key factor in overall health. I think I probably got very interested in it when I spent the summer in Harlan County, Kentucky, working for the United Mine Workers. And that was the first time I met people who had black lung disease. And that got me, then when I came back to Chapel Hill, interested in the cotton textile industry, which had thousands of people who worked in it every day in all of the towns in North and South Carolina who had a chronic lung disease that was not acknowledged to exist. That again led to a large campaign to think about medical care, compensation, prevention around cotton dust disease. And that was back in the 1970s. And that was how I got really interested in thinking about it as a public health prevention opportunity.
We think about workplace health, workplace hazards, not just as something that was of antiquity and not something in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. It's incredibly relevant today. Tell us a little bit about what is the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. I know because it's part of the National Institute of Health.
Yes, it is.
But our listeners might not really understand what it is and its scope.
Well, I'll say what's interesting about working at NIEHS is that it doesn't have a body part or a body system, as do most of the 26 institutes
like
that
exist. National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute.
Right, right. What's interesting about the scope of NIEHS,
which is the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, okay,
is that it covers all body systems and many organs in terms of thinking about how our genes and the environment interact with each other to perturb different body systems and different organ systems. And to me, that's one of the real hallmarks about the legacy of NIEHS, where we just celebrated our 50th anniversary here in North Carolina, that we've been able to pave new territory on environmental health issues and research that was not part of how we think about the body being perturbed, how the environment interacts with it. And actually, I do have another personal story. I'm actually a DES baby, and that is something that I got really concerned about, diethylstilbestrol, which my mother took when she was pregnant with me, which has affected me in certain ways and also members of my family. But in a sense, there's exposures that happen subsequent to us in our lives and to our future generations that we really don't know very much about. The hallmark of NIEHS right now with Dr. Birnbaum's leadership is around endocrine disruptors. And that's kind of another whole field of research that we still don't know a lot about and we have a lot to learn about, both in researching and also preventing exposure.
So the whole genetic aspect of this work is something that 20 years ago we might have dreamed about but wouldn't be in your day-to-day work environment. But today it is. How do you help workers understand that this is an important part of them being healthy in the workplace?
Well, I think partly it's about being aware of what you're exposed to and how it impacts you.
Like what?
Well,
Pick a substance.
Okay, stress. That's something that in my work with people in disasters, like being in Puerto Rico 2 weeks ago, I see as probably the longest term public health impact of the disaster, which again perturbs many body systems, affects our immune system, makes us susceptible to other diseases. But also, you know, we've built a program around responder resilience where we know that with mindfulness and with team care and self-care and organizational care, there's ways to mitigate the effects of stress. And that, obviously, that's not a chemical, but then we also have chemicals and stress interacting, and that makes for even more serious chronic health problems.
Well, and you've traveled the world. You've seen disasters up front. Maybe we could talk about one of those to start with. Talk about the World Trade Center, what you came across, and from your perspective, what you were worried about that was perhaps different than what other people might have been worried about.
Yes, I definitely, again, for listeners who remember the World Trade Center and remember the bucket brigades that happened of basically workers teaming into long lines with buckets to move rubble to be able to recover bodies, which went on for weeks. One of the first things that I and others I worked with questioned about this was, wasn't this like a Superfund site? Or wasn't this like an uncontrolled site where you sort of start thinking about protecting people who are engaged in those activities at that time? Those were issues that I think helped us as a country start to think about how health needs to be part of the mix in disaster response.
Shift gears for 1 second and let's go over to a different location, but another disaster, unfortunately, which would be something like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2011. Mm-hmm. What were the types of challenges that created for you and your team?
Again, those were very unique challenges because we had a ongoing deep water release that was unstoppable and uncappable. We also had a gigantic swath of toxic materials, oil, that was washing up on beaches. Our role was to figure out how to create an army to respond. And so the challenge that we had was working as a team with BP, which was a very interesting challenge that the federal government usually doesn't have, where what we had was what we call unified command. So each of the primary parties had to have joint decision-making about everything that we did. So our program helped to set up a training that lasted 4 hours that was delivered to 100,000 people. And of those 100,000 people, about 32,000 of them were part of the actual response. So we actually tried to figure out quickly what are the hazards that they face, what are the protective measures that they can take, and what are the long-term consequences of this exposure? So that was another very large response.
Wow. Yeah. This is unbelievably important and fascinating, sad, and at times exciting because of the impacts you're going to have. And we're going to continue to talk about these impacts. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with Chip Hughes, director of the Worker Education and Training Program, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, about reducing and preventing health hazards at work. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. And we're talking with Chip Hughes, director of the Worker Education and Training Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, about preventing and reducing health hazards at work, those that really impact the environment that we're in. And Chip, before the break, you were really telling us some amazing, challenging stories of really kind of responding to disasters, whether they be from terror or faulty lines that rupture, who knows. Most of your work is, though, about really helping those who are in day-to-day lives be safer and their lives are in. Tell us about the National Worker Education and Training Program that you lead.
Sure. We were born in 1986 as part of the Superfund Act, and what that did was create an extramural grant program to set up training programs for health and safety. So we actually fund unions, universities, community colleges, community organizations to build and develop training programs that are kind of customized and targeted to what we consider to be vulnerable populations who are in specific occupations where they face exposure to unregulated contaminants.
What would be some of the exposures that listeners may not actually be thinking so much about, but you think about all the time?
Yeah. Well, last week I was in New Mexico at WIP, the Waste Isolation Project. That is the nation's largest repository of nuclear waste that's buried underground. And that actual facility was shut down because of an explosion 2 years ago, I believe, and opened again this year. And obviously that relates to radiation exposure, but also to the normal work, in this case, of underground mining. So one of the things that we focus on, although we've been talking about disasters, as you alluded to, Adam, we're more concerned about daily life and the daily life on the job of how people actually protect themselves or are aware of the potential dangers that they face to make sure that disasters don't happen. And a lot of actually the focus that I was part of this past week in DOE was on building a safety culture within an organization. And that, again, has to do with going way beyond any OSHA standards or any regulations, but thinking about how do we actually build organizations that kind of have embedded within the consciousness of the workforce a sense of awareness of hazard, preparedness, prevention, and kind of those sort of good public health values that we feel need to be part of any organization, any day, in any workplace.
You mentioned OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. What's the difference between that and the NIEHS?
Yeah, NIEHS is a research organization. OSHA is a regulatory organization. So I'll say we try to help lead the way to having health and safety happen in the workplace. OSHA a lot of times has to maybe beat people over the head a little bit or issue fines, you know, to get people to do the right thing. I think both approaches can work. I feel like one of the challenges that we've faced is that we've seen really a lack of any regulation of chemicals. That sort of has ended. And so to be able to say to a person or a worker in a workplace that you're exposed to some safe level of a chemical, we really don't have that for most chemicals that we're exposed to.
Because the research isn't there?
Well, two parts. I mean, the research isn't there, but the regulations aren't there either. There was a really interesting story that was about cleaning chemicals and women who work in a number of occupations, and this related specifically to chronic obstructive lung disease, our problem being, and this is a key concern for NIHS, we have so many multiple simultaneous chemical exposures that it's really hard to tease out which exposure might be deleterious to you and which one might not be. So what we try to do in thinking both from a training point of view as well as from research is to attempt to get good data, good long-term studies to be able to document that there's health hazards that we know about and can prevent.
Yeah,
that's sort of our goal.
I love it because you're not only dealing with what's here, you're dealing with what can be. And I'm looking at a couple of your training programs, which I love the names. One is the Nuclear Worker Training Program, which I think you touched a little bit about what needs to be done. Another one is the Environmental Career Worker Training Program. Mm-hmm. What's that?
Well, we started that actually. Congressman Stokes started that in the 1990s. And that was to look at young people being able to be part of the environmental cleanup process in their own communities. At that time, we had kind of a paradigm where, the Bechtels and the Fluors, the large companies of the world, did environmental cleanup. And one of the concerns that we had back then was that local organizations, local companies, and local people should be part of this cleanup process. So that's something that we've done all around the country. Specifically with brownfields sites in mainly urban areas that have been redeveloped. So kind of as a tangent, we were trying to create a jobs program, although our focus was on health and safety.
Pretty radical that you're doing community empowerment.
Well, we sort of see that as a core part of what needs to be done.
Yeah,
and again, NIHS has a long history of doing that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I also saw the Ebola Biosafety and Infectious Disease Response Training, which clearly at a time and place just recently was so key. But I'm also struck by one of the trainings that you really lead is the Disaster Preparedness Training. What do we need to know? Because it is true that we're responding to disasters, but you're training folks to really think through how to improve the response.
Right.
What are we learning?
Well, I think we're learning that disasters are a core part of our society now and that the response and the recovery is a very long process. And I'd say first, the better you do in your job every day, the better you're going to do if a disaster happens. So we preach, if I could use that theological term, preparedness as part of kind of what all citizens, children in school, not just workers on the front line, need to think about. And that, I think that's something that is a message that's getting through of having that awareness happen as we have more large parts of our population be impacted. So that's still something that's a core part of our HAZMAT disaster preparedness program.
Our listeners may not appreciate, but I think the work that you and your team have done have saved thousands of lives across the country and tens of thousands in terms of people impacted and affected. And I wonder, what's it been like for you to go to areas? You see and experience things that are very stressful. How do you get your energy each day that allows you to continue to see ways of reducing and preventing these rather than perhaps succumbing to the stress yourself?
Mm-hmm. I feel that things that we think are good for other people are good for ourselves. So I really believe in being healthy and trying to figure out how to make sure you practice that every day. So I guess I would say the same message about preparedness and kind of how you live your life, that I feel like I try to figure out how to renew my spirit and my body as best I can. So I guess as a health educator, I preach that still.
You have received numerous awards, including the Health and Human Services Secretary's Award for Exceptional Service. And I just think we need to thank you for the work you're doing, the work your team is doing, the work that the NIEHS is doing for worker safety, and being our guest today on Your Health. Thank you so much.
Great. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
We've been talking with Chip Hughes, Director of the Worker Education Training Program at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, about ways that he helps people facing the most hazardous situations minimize their health risk. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jonathan and I are going to talk about listener health questions and concerns. And Jonathan, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question.
I'm having problems with my right hip. For the past few years, it was a rare, occasional pain. But now for several months, it has been hurting whenever I put weight on it or move it. I can't put socks on easily, and I have trouble reaching my foot when trying to bathe. Should I get an x-ray? Do you think I might have arthritis?
So common, and we know it's also painful.
And when it affects your everyday life, I think there's certain pains that you just put up with, but there's other times when it's getting in the way of you being able to do the things that you do every day. It becomes a big deal. Just hearing this story, it sounds like arthritis. And that there are certain times that we answer specific questions about the need for a joint replacement with an x-ray. And other times we take initial steps first saying, this sounds just like arthritis. We're going to treat it just like arthritis and work to get some improvement in that range of motion and that function that you have.
Which might mean going to a physical therapist.
Yeah, there's great research to show that the strengthening around the area of the joint can't bring back that cartilage and can't reduce any bone-on-bone wear and tear that may be happening, but it can help to take the load off of the joint, which can do just as much or more than any other medications or anything like that can do.
And we also have like door number three of the let's make a deal here, which could this could be something else. And two things that kind of come to mind, though I do agree with you, Jonathan, it sounds like arthritis of the hip. Could be bursitis of the hip that's not deep in the joint, but it's in kind of superficial, the area, kind of that sponginess around the hip area that can get inflamed. And every time you move it, it can be really sore and painful. And sometimes that can trick doctors too. So you really need to be seen for that, because that treatment actually is a lot easier. And then finally, on the other end of the spectrum, it can be maybe coming from the back. And maybe it's what we call spinal stenosis, where you have these nerves that are getting compressed. Ah, that's more difficult. In either case, I do think you need to come in and be seen.
I agree. It's always nice when I'm able to take care of a question over the phone, but I think sometimes nothing replaces that physical exam.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I was diagnosed with trigeminal neuralgia a year ago. It continues to be painful in my face and mouth. I'm taking a medication, but it doesn't seem to be fully working. Do you have any other recommendations?
Well, first off, we should probably define a little bit for our listeners what is trigeminal neuralgia, which is really two different words, trigeminal and neuralgia.
The trigeminal nerve is one of the main nerves that goes through the face, and it's a sensory nerve. So we feel a lot of things with that nerve, particularly pain, especially when it is misfiring. And this neuralgia, this nerve pain, can be particularly disabling for people. It really affects people's everyday lives. And it's described as a lancinating pain in medical textbooks. I don't know the last time I've used lancinating in an everyday conversation, but it's a sharp shooting pain, this electrical sensation on one side of the face. Oftentimes it can be set off by things just as simple as shaving your face.
Yeah, it can be so painful, and it's not an easy diagnosis. A lot of times you make it on clinical grounds, the symptoms that people have. And though the question sometimes comes up, do you need to do further imaging? Do you need to go looking for it? Because usually you may not see it on the traditional imaging. You may not even see it on advanced imaging. And it's assumed to be some nerve compression at somewhere higher up in the brain areas that may be impacting. And so sometimes we actually just try to treat it.
There's one very straightforward first-line option that we use for most people called carbamazepine. And that works all right. We have to try to increase the dose as much as possible. And working to get it to the maximum dose while tolerating the side effects is our first option. But there are several medication options down the road. Some names, just to list a few, could be baclofen, oxcarbazepine, or lamotrigine. That's just to give you an idea of there are several other options for medications that if one isn't working for you, maybe another one will.
Yeah, and you know, this is a really important here to really get the right diagnosis because, you know, if you have pain on one side of the face that's going in the area where that nerve goes around, it has attacks that can last a couple minutes. It can be real severe. And even just like something like the wind going across your face triggering attack, these are the sorts of things that can give a real clinical clue. And then you probably, in most cases, I think they're going to end up getting an MRI to make sure that it's not something that needs a surgical approach, like a tumor, and then going to one of those treatments that you indicated. So it's going to require working with someone who really has some interest, understanding. You may even need to even go to some higher levels of care, sometimes injection with botulinum I've heard of. But, you know, in that, you're probably going to be working with a neurologist. Laura, what's our very last house call?
My father's in a nursing home and wears a condom catheter. Because he can't communicate anymore, how do I know when he actually has a urinary tract infection? It seems to me like his urine is often a little cloudy.
So a condom catheter is where you have a tube that's not actually inside the penis, but it goes around like almost like a rubber band. And so when he urinates, which maybe he is incontinent of urine and can't control it, and or they don't want, which I wouldn't want either, to sit in urine all day long. And so it drains out and goes into a bag that can be emptied. And the real question is, how often is it likely that he actually has a urinary tract infection?
Adam, this is a challenging question and a great question because it is hard to tell. And we don't want to overtreat because the risks of overtreating are causing antibiotic resistance so that when a serious infection does come down the road, we might have run out of all good antibiotic options for treating an infection. Oftentimes in this situation, I say, if he's having a hard time communicating and we know that there's a risk for getting urinary tract infections, we look at the things that can give us clues, which would be changes in mental status, particularly with fevers. And if we're seeing both of those things, then I might test the urine. If we were to test the urine at any other time without any other symptoms, we still might find some bacteria growing. That doesn't mean that there's a urinary tract infection necessarily. It might just be a normal, natural bacterial colonization or growth of bacteria there that isn't actually causing any disease. So my goals are to make sure that people don't die unnecessarily and to make sure that we can treat their symptoms. If this isn't causing any symptoms of confusion and pain, and if it's not going to be something that's going to hasten an unnecessary death, then I say, let's just keep watching over this and we wait and save the antibiotics for when they're truly needed.
Wise advice. You may have a future in geriatrics here. I can tell that this is something because those are such a practical way of going through an issue and avoiding the complications, but yet treating what needs to be treated. Thank you.
Of course.
Well, that'll conclude your health today. We want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. We hope we've answered questions and concerns important to you and your health. If you want to ask us your own questions, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, my great guest co-host, Dr. Jonathan Fricke, and our guest today, Chip Hughes. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jonathan Fricke.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.